local historians gather with research on settling and resettling the Plains. From SDPB, today is Thursday, April 17th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, we preview the Dakota Conference at the Center for Western Studies. We'll talk about what it means to settle land and steward land in modern South Dakota through the lens of history. We talk with Harry Thompson, authors Norma and Jerry Wilson, and archaeologist Gina Pilewski. We await the sunrise on Mount Rushmore on Easter Sunday. That's coming a bit later in the hour. But first, we preview a water conference that explores the health of the Big Sioux River. Travis Entenmann joins us after the news. We are broadcasting today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. The city of Sioux Falls is partnering with South Dakota State University to host the Big Sioux Stewardship Summit. The two-day event began on Wednesday and carries on today. Travis Entenmann is Executive Director of Friends of the Big Sioux River. He joined me in the studio.
For the past handful of years, the city has had a Big Sioux River Water Summit. And we wanted to bring, and last year was the Big Sioux River and Sustainability Summit, and they wanted to bring in more voices and more of the general public to this conference. So they partnered with primarily SDSU, South Dakota State University, to bring in more students and just expand the audience and kind of shift it to the Big Sioux River Stewardship Summit. They moved it from December to April. It's a big change to be more aligned with like Earth Month and Earth Day.
Sure.
And they added in a regenerative agriculture track. Again, bringing those rural voices, those ag voices to Sioux Falls and getting more folks understanding kind of the inner relationship of agriculture and water quality and everything.
Seems like a key connection to make.
There would be a key connection to make. And kind of with that, on the 16th, we had two tours running, an agricultural tour and an urban sustainability tour. So the agricultural tour was looking at what, you know, dairy producers are doing or what corn and soy producers are doing, all the way to small vegetable producers, and just talk about what they're trying to do on their properties to understand or that impact water quality in the city of Sioux Falls and why that's important and why we all need to kind of understand where our food comes from and what producers are doing to help, you know, the larger picture of stewardship.
There are so many people in Sioux Falls who come from rural South Dakota or rural Northwest Iowa or rural Southwest Minnesota, and they've all moved to the city. So there's a connection, but yet you can quickly become disconnected with what it was like to grow up in those places when you were a little kid. And those places change rapidly.
I heard a stat. I don't know if this is 100% accurate, but roughly like, 30% of South Dakota population now lives within 30 minutes of downtown Sioux Falls.
So
our urban centers are growing from folks out of state, but also from our rural communities coming to the city. So you just naturally lose that connection with, you know, agriculture and natural environment potentially. So it's important for us to engage because there's fewer and fewer people owning more and more land. And they're controlling large swaths of property that impact everyone's day-to-day, from water quality to food to, you know, soil in the air.
You know?
So making that connection, and conferences like this is a way for us to do that.
Yeah. So what was the tour like? Were there things that you learned on the tour or that you saw other people kind of light bulb moments that other people were having?
Yeah. So one area, we went to the Bodewine Dairy. Lynn Bodewine gave us a tour of his operation. And, you know, being a dairy and a large-scale dairy for the area, having folks kind of understand and realize, you know, what within the system someone's given, what they're trying to do for, say, water quality. So, you know, some dairies are reusing their water. So they're using less new fresh water and trying to recycle it as much as possible. They have methane digesters. So instead of having that methane just go up into the atmosphere, they're trying to collect it and use it for other purposes. So, you know, while nothing is perfect, obviously, folks, tours like this will help folks understand what people are trying to do. It's not just you're an egg producer and you're, you know, polluting our river. Well, I mean, there's nuance in everything. And
Right.
So a lot of folks are understanding, coming out, you know, like what soil health means and why that is important for people that live in Sioux Falls. Or small vegetable producers, you know, what's the hurdles for them to even make a living so you have local produce. Yeah.
All right, you're going to talk about the lifeline of the river for the future in your talk on Thursday during the summit.
Yes.
Give us a preview of what you're bringing to the table that day.
Yeah, I wanted to take the opportunity to, one, introduce Friends of the Big Sioux River to folks that don't know who we are, and take the opportunity to talk, you know, what we've seen with the river, what are some of the issues we're finding, what the community as a whole can do to help improve it, but also just give folks an update on activities that we're working on, events that we're going to be participating in the summer, and that the community can participate in to help have a positive impact on our watershed.
Yeah. So people want to know, and I've been to your conferences where you talk about tracking the water quality over time. And so people want to know what the health of the river is.
Yeah.
That's a very hard question to answer in a word.
Yeah.
But do you have an elevator pitch for how healthy is the Big Sioux River?
In a short synopsis, I would say, you know, it is not getting worse. And we are seeing positive trends that things are improving long term. The thing about the river is it took us, you know, 100 plus years to get it to this point.
Yeah.
So I got to take us that long to improve it. But when you're trying to help have a positive impact on the environment, it's going to take a while. So we are seeing positive trends and people are starting to buy into the idea that we need a clean watershed for the growth of South Dakota.
Yeah. Tough times for ag.
Yeah.
Tough political times for people as they figure, you know, no matter what side of the political spectrum you're on, there are some changes happening. I think that's safe to say that everybody is a little uncertain about what's going to happen tomorrow or next week.
Yeah.
As they sort things through. And that can be a time where people feel uncertain and make decisions based with on the information they have. Where do people go to think long term? Or is that a foolish thing to say? Every farmer's thinking long term, right?
Right.
But they're also thinking short term.
Yeah, it's a weird bit. I mean, you have to think long term sustainability. I think any business does while maximizing short term profits and all that fun stuff. It's a challenge, especially ag economies are really beholden to outside, you know, market prices and legislation and policies coming out of DC. So there's a whole lot of a lot of inputs that are not in their control. You know, coming to conferences like the Big Sioux Stewardship Summit or working with, you know, their local conservation districts or working with their, you know, Ducks Unlimited or the Soil Health Coalition, their local groups to understand what's possible that they have in their community for either cost sharing or education or projections for what, you know, other producers are seeing, I think is vital to kind of help weather any storm, no pun intended. But, you know, it's an ever-changing landscape for producers.
Yeah.
And I don't see it being easier anytime soon.
Yeah. You flew into Washington recently.
I did, yes.
And how was that experience?
Overall positive. I mean, one thing we really kind of harped on is, you know, we need a new farm bill. The farm bill provides a lot of resources for South Dakota, and in particular, a lot of resources for our agricultural community. And being that it's 2 years late so far, moving forward, there's going to be programs that might not be offered because there's no farm bill. There's no guarantee. You can't. Farm bills every 4 to 5 years, there's a new one. And if you're not passing one, it's hard for folks to plan 4 years in advance because they don't know the funding might not be there for them to help them navigate, you know, weather issues or commodity prices issues. So we really focused on that while we were there. And then also releasing Inflation Reduction Act funding that has benefited South Dakota greatly over the past few years. We met with staff members from all three of our Congress folks, and you know, they seem positive. They are all understanding that we need a farm bill. We need our aid community to be successful. But there's just a lot of unknowns happening, and I'm finding that a lot of folks just don't have any answers.
Yeah, well, we'll leave it there. The Big Sioux Stewardship Conference will have some answers, hopefully. And I'll be on stage having a conversation with some artists to talk about how the river has inspired their art. And we'll put some links up for everybody on our website, sdpb.org. Travis, thanks for stopping by.
Thank you.
You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. The 57th Annual Dakota Conference is coming up April 24th and 25th. The 2025 theme is Settling and Resettling the Plains. The Dakota Conference is the oldest and largest annual humanities conference focused on topics specific to the Northern Plains region. Harry Thompson is executive director for the Center for Western Studies at Augustana University. He joined me in the Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls to preview the event.
Well, we're a research agency, and we fulfill that mission in a number of different ways at Augustana. And, of course, we're part of Augustana. We're unique in many ways. We have our own board of directors and our own sources of income, but we work in a mutually beneficial way with the university to provide resources to the community and also to the campus. We started in 1964 with English professor Herbert Krauss, who was also at that time writer in residence. And his goal was to amass as many resources as he possibly could about this part of the country, which we call the Northern Plains. And his idea of resources in the 1960s was, of course, books. Mm-hmm. And we've maintained our book collection. We've increased our book collection over the years, but then we've, of course, added a rather sizable collection of archival material. In the broadest, from photographs to letters to diaries to journals. And we have a lot of people from around the country and even overseas, and as well as our own faculty and students who use those materials. And then we wanted to make sure this information was provided more widely, and so we started a publishing program. So we're still the only university-affiliated book publisher in the state of South Dakota since 1978.
Yeah.
And then we've grown through the acquisition, you might say, of the Dakota Conference, which started at Dakota State University in 1969. And that's one of our annual programs. The Bow Forum, which we started in 1995 as an idea that former Governor Nils Bow had to provide resource material through the through individuals as opposed to books or diaries. He wanted individuals to be able to come to Sioux Falls, but also more broadly South Dakota, and talk about issues that affect the people of this part of the country, but are known perhaps better by people elsewhere in the country or overseas even.
Yeah. John Meacham was just here. I was in the audience for that. That was a really great presentation. One of the things that, I mean, I say this all the time, so I'm going to say it again. One of my favorite parts is when the students ask questions, and President Stephanie Hersess-Sandlin is just so good at making sure that if the guest on the stage does not answer the question, that she provides a follow-up to direct him back to what the student is asking. And I just love how thoughtfully Augustana does that. And how she does that in particular, and what amazing jobs the students do. Mm-hmm. Biased, I'm an Augie grad, so there, that's my little go Augie moment. All right, so this conference, the Dakota Conference, what is it this year? This year has, every year has a theme, and you ask, you know, call for papers, you call for research, presentations, and people come from all over the region, really, to present their work. Tell us a little bit about the conference.
Okay, this year's theme on settling and resettling the plains. Really, the origin of the idea is with the centennial celebration of Ole Rovog's Giants in the Earth. Giants in the Earth, as you know, was originally published in 1925, but the English version came out in 1927. And we met with the South Dakota Symphony Orchestra and have been working with them on ways that we could perhaps provide some additional information about Rovog. So that was the origin of the concept of celebrating Rovog and tying it to the idea of settling this part of the country. And then resettling, because we always have to remember that our Native American friends were here before the European Americans arrived, and they have every right to claim that they settled this part of the country and that the Europeans came later and resettled. And of course, as we all know, settling and resettling continues on. We have people from Sudan and Ghana and Asian countries settling in South Dakota all the time. So we see that as a continuum, and the conference wanted to take a look at that concept. But it's also, the Dakota Conference this year is also part of our two-year effort to observe or celebrate, you might say, the 250th anniversary of the United States, at least the signing of the Declaration of Independence. And this year's conference will be kind of a forerunner of next year's conference. We're not entirely sure what angle we're going to take. Our board and council members are meeting at the end of this year's Dakota Conference to fashion some concepts for that. And then also the the Bow Forum is another program that's part of a two-year observance of America's 250th. And then to complement all that, we have gallery exhibits. And in 2026, we'll bring out a book, America's Longest River, which runs right through the Northern Plains. And, of course, it's the Missouri River.
Yeah. Oh, wow. So how do you – you've answered the question somewhat by telling us what you're doing. But when you look at something like the 250th anniversary and you sit down for the first time and say, I mean, that is an enormous topic. What is essential for us to think about and consider at this time? As we move into this anniversary, what is essential? How do you answer that question?
Well, I don't necessarily answer it, but some of our speakers will answer that question. Yeah. And in fact, we are sponsoring a panel discussion on that very topic. What to keep and not repeat is the key phrase there that a panel of our board members and council members, and then Irene Chang, representing the Korean community, will tackle that topic. You know, what is it about America's 250 years that we're happy about, that we want to keep? And then what are some of the things that we wish we hadn't experienced or perhaps no longer want to have as part of the American character?
Yeah. There are so many things in this conference that are coming up. Thematically, though, what are their highlights that you see that you want to let audience members know today to come and check out from the conference?
Well, there are a number of presentations about immigration, about the Homestead Act of 1862, about Rovog himself. But then also there's a session on the Germans from Russia and the impact of that group from the late 19th century to the present. There will be a panel discussion as well. A number of different ethnic groups, in addition to, you know, the Norwegians, of course, celebrating the 200th year of Norwegian immigration into the United States. There's an international celebration going on between Norway and the United States over the on the occasion of the 200th anniversary of Norwegian immigration.
That's Harry Thompson with a preview of the 57th annual Dakota Conference on the Northern Plains. The conference is Thursday, April 24th and Friday, April 25th. Now you're going to hear from some of the conference's presenters for a little preview. In about 15 minutes, we welcome Norma and Jerry Wilson back to our airwaves. But first, Gina Pilewski. She's an assistant director of research at Augustana University's Archaeology Laboratory. Her presentation is called Exhibiting South Dakota, Fossils, Artifacts, and, quote, Indian Relics at the 1893 Chicago World's Fair. A note to listeners, we will discuss human remains in this conversation, wounded knee artifacts, and sacred items on display at the fair. Some may find parts of this conversation disturbing.
So I've been working on a project that investigates Fred Pettigrew's involvement in collecting materials for exhibit at the South Dakota building at the World's Fair in 1893. And Center for Western Studies houses an archive of his personal papers. And so the call for papers that came out was, you know, very much a good pairing there to present that research.
Now, Fred is the brother of the senator, Richard Pettigrew.
Yes.
Okay. All right. How would he have described himself? What was he thinking when he was gathering things in this landscape?
That's a great question. I'm not entirely sure.
Yeah.
The documentary evidence of his actual field work is scant.
Okay.
So he's not what we would consider an archaeologist. Sometimes people call him an amateur archaeologist. He was not professionally trained and frankly didn't document things in the way and to the level that we would expect for archaeologists even of his day. I think it would be more appropriate to call him an artifact hunter or even a looter, potentially.
If I call him an opportunist, am I being too harsh?
No, he was definitely entrepreneurial in his approach, and this is what also sets him apart from archaeologists. A lot of his collecting was very much in an antiquarian fashion of concern about the objects themselves and not necessarily the context and association that they're found in.
Okay.
So, right, for archaeologists, once those things are removed from the ground, you can't reconstruct and put them back. And so as he was taking artifacts, he didn't always mark the associations closely. There's very little documentation.
Yeah.
But his main occupation was as a land surveyor, and he also had a real estate business that he ran.
Yeah. Okay, so that puts some pieces together about the kind of person he is and the work that he's doing at the time that he lived. What kind of collection, if we can call it that, did he amass?
His personal collections were vast, and a lot of those are represented at the Pettigrew House and Museum today.
Yeah, there's a lot
of
things that he had his hands on,
Yes. So he was interested in everything from fossil specimens, geological specimens, all the way to archaeological materials. There are collections of human remains in some of the images that he has, and he also collected what we would consider today ethnographic materials, so things that were made and used by contemporary Native people, so people that would have been alive at the same time that he was alive.
And tell us a little bit about the World's Fair then.
The 1893 Chicago World's Fair, also known as the World's Columbian Exposition, was a major event in American cultural history. And it celebrated the 400th anniversary of the arrival of Christopher Columbus. And so this fair went on for 6 months in 1893, visited by millions of people. Fred Pettigrew was involved in putting together an exhibit in the South Dakota building. Mm. So the exhibit that he amassed for the World's Fair consisted of fossils, archaeological artifacts, mostly things that he had collected with his brother from Blood Run, which is an archaeological site near Good Earth State Park. And then he also actually published in newspapers asking fellow South Dakotans to contribute what he called, quote unquote, Indian relics, both ancient and modern. And some of those, based on the letters that he received that were preserved in the archive, were contemporary materials that were actually removed from victims of the Wounded Knee Massacre.
Really?
And so he was in touch with several people who offered up artifacts and relics that they had removed from the dead or from the area after the fact.
And brought them for display.
Yeah, so right now we're in the process of trying to, we'd love to find a photo of the interior of the building. We don't have that yet. Trying to trace whether the artifacts actually made it to display has been challenging.
Okay.
So we know that he was offered some of these materials. We know that some of them were shipped to him. So there was a drum, a sacred drum, that had been shipped to him. And we also know that one of the people who wrote to him, George Bartlett, ended up going to the fair as a sort of supervisor to a group of, he proposed to bring 70 people from Pine Ridge Reservation with him. So we know that Bartlett ended up at the fair. We are not entirely sure if those materials that he had removed from Wounded Knee also went with him. So that is still a question.
Yeah.
Which brings up this point of two things I want to talk about. And one is that as a modern day historian, you're always looking for that missing piece of information, and it might exist. You might find it in an archive, in a, you know, someone's personal collection, or in a library archive or a university archive somewhere.
Right.
How hard is it to find the needle in that haystack?
Oh, that's a great question. I wish I knew the answer ahead of time. That would sure make things easier. So we started on this project, and I say we because I've been working on this with an undergrad student at Augustana. And we have focused first at the archive of the Center for Western Studies. And after the conference, we're planning on expanding to other archives in the state.
Yeah.
So other universities do have collections. It's not clear whether we'll find that, you know, the quote-unquote smoking gun of, you know, a photo of the exhibit. And we have been able to find, thanks to a lot of the digitization efforts that have gone on for newspapers, we have found articles that are reviews of the exhibit. They tend to focus on the fossils.
Okay.
So that remains a question. We do have evidence. There's one mention of bones that predate Adam, right, of people. And so there are clues about human remains being there. We have plates, so photographic plates that show collections that Pettigrew likely brought to the World's Fair as well. And so we have inklings, but we haven't been able to find the exact layout of the exhibit.
Yeah. I'm struggling with the right words here because there are so many layers to this story, and I want to be careful. So I'll just be honest about how I'm feeling. How would that be? And it's like I'm shocked and I'm disgusted.
Yes.
And I'm saddened and I'm having these emotional responses as a person living
Absolutely.
In 2025 that this would have been something acceptable.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just going to put that out there and say it.
I felt very similarly. When I saw these letters in the archive, it's really disturbing to see people talking so openly about removing things from
a massacre site.
A massacre
and
site.
And sacred items.
Yeah. And unfortunately, this is very common.
Yeah, this is the reality.
This is the reality. And this was, you know, just 3 years prior to the World's Fair that all of this happened. This is not the only instance where artifacts were looted in this manner. We have other examples from throughout the country of not just the artifacts, but also the human remains, in some cases, ending up in museum contexts, in museum collections.
Yeah. So this becomes really important historical work to find the truth beyond the speculation. To put the evidence in the record, to find the evidence in the record and assemble it in different ways. I'm curious as well, when you talk about Blood Run, if the behavior was different, what could you have learned from a site like that about people and how they lived on that landscape?
Absolutely. We have lost collectively a lot, archaeologically. We've lost a lot from looting activities that have happened. There are portions of the site that were destroyed. The loss of information is severe, but ultimately I do think that there are some sites that, and this is maybe unusual for an archaeologist to say, but I'm informed by some of the tribal historic preservation officers that we've worked with that not everything needs to be known. In the case of burial mounds, I think that there is very little that we should be doing to those sites and structures, right?
Yeah.
Unless we are asked to do that in some kind of capacity because of, a natural disaster or some sort of unusual situation. But excavating for the sake of excavating, for the sake of excavating a burial ground, not necessary.
Anything you would leave our listeners with from your work right now that has particularly surprised you or that you have found noteworthy where you're like, that has pointed me in a different direction than I expected, for example?
Sometimes it's okay to go down the rabbit hole.
Nice.
to follow those curiosities.
Yeah.
This project got started because as part of my work at the archaeology lab, we have been working on a complete inventory of all of the Native American cultural items that we have for NAGPRA, yeah. So the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act. And this research came about because we found boxes in the basement in our storage area, and we found a large piece of pottery that was actually featured in one of those plates. And so it really made me curious. And this entire project, we tugged at one string, and this whole thing has just unraveled in such a way.
Yeah.
Or I guess been knitted together. More so the opposite of this one, I guess.
Yeah.
But following that curiosity, I try to encourage students to do that.
Gina Pilewski is Assistant Director of Research at Augustana University's Archaeology Laboratory. She is presenting Exhibiting South Dakota Fossils, Artifacts, and, quote, Indian Relics at the 1893 Chicago World's Fair. We're going to hear from two other presenters now. Norma and Jerry Wilson's talk is called Settling and Caretaking at the Dakota Conference. I connected with them on the phone.
We have three parts to our presentation. The settling on the land and building our house, the restoration of the old log house, the oldest house, the Norwegian immigrant's house, and the conservation of the land, the planting and burning and all the other things we've had to do to bring back the native grasses and porbs.
Yeah. I'm curious to know if you thought of yourself as settlers at any time.
I don't think we imagined it quite that way, but in thinking about this conference theme, I feel that we were kind of resettling or rehomesteading because well, the land we built on had never been built on, but then it was surrounded by this historic prairie. And, you know, the Seversons who arrived in 1869, they built this log house, and it was inhabited by three generations of that one family for 100 years. Then when the last two sons of the third generation died, it was vacated then for about 30 years before we acquired it and acquired responsibility to keep it standing. And it's on the National Register of Historic Places. And so we were homesteading in a way by building a unique house that is in the hillside and it's passive solar and very energy efficient, but then also taking on the responsibility of maintaining the oldest house in Clay County, an immigrant house. So and also, of course, the restoration of the prairie, which has always been dear to my heart. You know, in a time when all the pasture land is being taken over by cedar trees and imported brome grass, it's been very important to us to restore and maintain native prairie species on all of the open land that we have.
And Jerry, both you and Norma have written about this as well. So it's also, I mean, it's a lot of physical labor, it's a lot of research and application and forming partnerships, but how did your writing, I'll start with you, Jerry, and then ask Norma the same thing, how did this way of living and settling and resettling impact your professional work as writers?
Well, I guess I've written six books, and two of which are particularly pertain to life here on the prairie, and I've never gone seeking a subject for a book. they find me, and I just once I feel compelled and feel that I have a story to tell, I put them out pretty fast, actually. Not that I don't spend lots of time in revision, but this particular book, Waiting for Coyote's Call, is an attempt to, it covers 25 years, the first 25 years here on the prairie, that I have grown to love. I grew up in a rural area in western Oklahoma, and after living in various cities and towns for years, was very happy to come back and sort of reclaim my roots on this land, and see what I could do to restore it, I guess. So that's been my main motivation with Waiting for Coyote's Call. And then a sort of sequel that came out a few years later, Seasons of the Coyote, is 103 stories or essays that span one calendar year, concerning encounters with the natural world of which I'm part here.
Yeah. And Norma, it's really impacted your poetry as well.
It's very much impacted my life, and yeah. my poetry is based on that. I think that also the fact that I came here having spent a great deal of time studying Native American literature and Native poetry in particular. One of my early books was a book on Native poetry, which is all mostly about people's relationship to the earth, to the animals, to the land, to the natural landscape that they belong to. So I came to feel, when I came to see this land where we live, I looked out at the horizon and you could see so far. I loved the view, and I came to love what was on the prairie. Like this morning, I took a walk. I never know what I'm going to see or find. But an imported animal, the pheasant, flew up out of the grass. Mm-hmm. On the pond below the place, I saw ducks. I went looking to see if I could find any wild plum blossoms, and they were just beginning to come out. The leaves are just coming out in the spring. It's so beautiful. So I write about the beauty of the natural land, and that's probably my main topic with poetry.
Both of your work also shows the world there's another way to be on the land. You didn't have to do things in this particular way. You made a lot of choices. Jerry, what do you hope to leave behind in that sense, on the land and in your book? When you think about legacy, and it's too soon to think about legacy really, but do you consider what comes after your time as a caretaker of this place?
Oh yeah, I give that a lot of thought. When Norma and I put all of our property in the Northern Prairies Land Trust perpetual conservation easement, we did so to ensure the likelihood that it would never be returned to farmland, because it's not appropriate for farmland. It's hilly, and yet it was farmed for 75 or 80 years, and most of the topsoil washed off the hillsides. But the native prairies are slowly restoring the soil, and they do so because they have very deep roots. They're drought resistant, and they evolved here because they're able to adapt to this climate and to changing conditions. And so that's probably the most important thing we're leaving behind. What troubles me is that while the conservation easement details what cannot be done on the property, further buildings, roads, conversion of land back to cropland, etc., there's no way this side of the grave that we can dictate that whoever owns it in the future will do what's necessary to work with nature to maintain it. As you know, the eastern red cedar tree, which is a native tree, has become a plague due to fire suppression and other measures of man that have overgrazing and so on, that have allowed it to take over vast stretches, including all along the Bluff Road here where we live. And it's so that's my main concern, that it come into the hands of people who have shared values and who understand, and most of all, who are able and willing to do the work, because it requires continuous work. We're going to have a prairie burn sometime within the next few weeks, weather permitting, and that's an essential element of prairie preservation. We've used grazing and one time haying, but the prairie burning, the prescribed burn, is essential to the health of the prairie. And, you know, before white settlers came, there were naturally ignited fires that burned great swaths of the prairie. And of course, the buffalo followed those areas because the grass was greener and more enriching. And so that's my main concern, is that we're going to lose control and hope that somebody who cares as much as we do about these things will carry on.
Yeah. Norma, let's wrap up with a little preview of what people might hear at the Dakota Conference if they come to your session.
Well, I think one thing they'll hear is that all along the way in our process of settling and resettling, we've found so many friends who were willing and able and happy to help us. We could not have done it alone. We could not have built our house alone. And some of those friends have passed away. Some have gone, moved elsewhere, but they were very helpful to us. And also, in terms of the burn, friends of ours who had walked on the land and who had learned about prairie here are involved in planning this prescribed burn on our land. So I'm hopeful that there'll be a continued interest in this uniquely natural place, in trying to conserve it, and particularly the grass, the native grass that is so important to sequester the carbon dioxide and help to mitigate climate change. And we hope we can spread the word about that, and more people will want to preserve prairie and do the things that need to be done to make the land more healthy.
The 2025 Dakota Conference is April 24th and 25th at Augustana University. You can hear Norma and Jerry's presentation on settling and caretaking there, as well as our previous guests' talk on exhibitions at the 1893 World's Fair in Chicago. That was Gina Pilewski. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Christians celebrate Easter Sunday this weekend. If you're an early riser and looking for festivities in the Black Hills, look no further than the annual event at Mount Rushmore. a collection of community churches are planning a sunrise service for Sunday at the monument. John Espasti is a church committee member who helps plan the event. He joined us from SDPB's Black Hills Surgical Hospital studio in Rapid City with a preview.
This is year number 77.
Oh, wow. How did it all get started?
The best way to explain this is to put it into the context of Lincoln's of the people, by the people, for the people. It was started by people in the Black Hills, has been run by people in the Black Hills, and it's for anyone who wants to show up, believers, non-believers, who just want to have a unique way of celebrating Easter at Mount Rushmore. The first celebration was April 1st, 1949. Miss Phyllis Gladstetter, the Sunday school teacher for the 7th and 8th grade in Hill City, held a celebration on Turtle Rock on Bishop Mountain behind the newly completed Mount Rushmore. There was 2 inches of snow and 200 people. There was a second celebration the same day, the same time, with about 50 people down along Grizzly Creek near Keystone. The next year, they combined the two churches and had a bigger, better celebration. In April 17th of 1947, it was held at the Sculptor Studio in Mount Rushmore. So it changed over time and grew and grew and grew. The poet laureate Badger Clark gave sermons there. Here's my my favorite one. In 1957, there was construction at Mount Rushmore, so they moved the celebration up onto the Peter Norbeck Overlook, and they loaded a upright piano in the back of a pickup truck and drove it up there. And a lady named Lois Halley did the accompaniment, and she ended it with a rousing rendition of God Bless America, and the crowd loved it. And to this day, it is a longstanding tradition. We still end the celebration by a group singing of God Bless America.
So what else happens this week? Who are your special presenters?
Well, I'm going to be doing a rendition of Badger Clark's A Cowboy Prayer. We have ministers from Hermosa and Keystone and Hill City. There's the Hill City Praise Band. Just different folks from around the area presenting the Easter message, doing little sermons, and lots of singing and music.
Any logistics that people need to understand to make the most of the morning?
That is very important, yet at the same time, remarkably simple. The celebration begins in the amphitheater at 7 a.m., so we recommend you show up anytime between 6 and 6:30. Parking is free until 7:15, so show up between 6 and 6:30, get parked, and make your way to the amphitheater, which is about a 200-yard walk, and we suggest you dress for the weather. Definitely warm shoes, coat, hat, gloves. Bring something warm and soft to sit on, because they have the wooden benches up at the amphitheater, and they can be a bit cold and a bit hard. And so, you know, dress for the weather, be comfortable.
Why do you show up year after year? What's special about it for you?
Well, it's kind of like the rites of spring. It's to me, it's the beginning of the fun time of the year, the nice time of the year, spring and summer and fall, and seeing people that you haven't seen all winter, and suddenly they show up. It's a celebration.
That's John Espasti previewing an Easter church service on Sunday, April 20th at Mount Rushmore. It's bright and early with services beginning at 7 a.m. local time. We'll put more information on our website. That's sdpb.org/news. And that is our show for today. We hope that it served you in the moment. It's produced by Ellen Kester and Ari Youngeman. Our videographer is Jordan Henderson. Our executive producer is Kara Hetland. From all of us here at SDPB, I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.